This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton.
The Supreme Court handed businesses a victory over employees in another case involving class action suits versus arbitration. Lamps Plus v. Varela involved a California-based retailer of various lighting products who disclosed 1,300 employee W-2 forms during a phishing scam. The hacker then used employee Frank Varela's information to file a fraudulent income tax return. Varela had signed an arbitration agreement when he was hired, but he still filed a suit against the company on behalf of himself and his co-workers. Lower courts agreed that the contract was ambiguous and allowed the suit to proceed, but in a 5-4 ruling, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the company. Justice John Roberts, writing the opinion for the majority, referred back to the 1925 Federal Arbitration Act, which says that arbitration takes place on a one-to-one basis, employee with employer, and not in a class action form. With more on the decision by the Supreme Court and its impact, we are joined here in studio by Neil Mahrija, who is an attorney at the firm of Berger Montague and also a lecturer here at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And also with us is Brian Berkey, assistant professor in the Department of Legal Studies and Business Ethics here at the Wharton School. He's also an assistant professor of philosophy here at Penn and a fellow in residence at Harvard University's Safra Center for Ethics. Neil, great to meet you. Thank you for coming
in. Great to meet you.
Thank you. Brian, great to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks to be back.
Thank you. I guess let's start, Neil, by going back and informing people what the 1925 Federal Arbitration Act was and how it kind of has continued to play in, especially with some of these cases most recently.
Sure. So this decision, first of all, is really just the latest in a whole series of decisions by the current Supreme Court that has ruled in favor of limiting class actions through a variety of means under the FAA. So just last year, there was another decision called Epic Systems versus Lewis, where the Supreme Court decided that class waivers, which could be included in contracts, were permissible and not a violation of the National Labor Relations Act, and they said the FAA governed. So that was something that happened a year ago, and this is just the latest. So it's really no surprise that the Supreme Court is taking another step limiting class actions. What's interesting about this is that the court seems to go a little bit further in that usually there's basic contract principles that are followed in the lower courts. So in this circumstance, Varela sued. The lower court said the contract doesn't say you can't have a class arbitration, right. And so we're going to use a general California principle, which may be a principle in other states, which is that if it's ambiguous, we're going to interpret it against the person who drafted the agreement, which in this case is Lamps Plus.
Right.
So the Supreme Court said that principle doesn't apply here or that the FAA preempts it because because that principle would be at odds with the overall mission of the FAA, which is to make things kind of speedy less complicated in their view. But that is what the Supreme Court, Justice Kagan says in her dissent, is making – that's a policy judgment that a class arbitration is speedier or less costly because it may be less costly than one arbitration filed by Varela, the plaintiff.
Right.
But it may not be if 1,000 people file arbitrations. So it's really a judgment of this Supreme Court that is saying that class arbitration procedure is not something that was envisioned under the FAA, and the FAA really is about individual proceedings.
Brian, how do you see this case and react to it in terms of the relationship between the employee and the employer? Because that's a huge part of this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is kind of yet another case in which the Supreme Court has kind of in effect sided with business and kind of the interests of business against kind of employees, consumers, and so on. This case in particular strikes me, though, as not necessarily kind of in itself having significant kind of long-term effects, only because What was at issue in the case was a clause in Varela's contract that was viewed by the lower courts as ambiguous, and then there's this sort of California provision that requires reading ambiguous clauses against the interests of the drafter. But the court, even the dissenters, the more kind of liberal justices, you know, don't take the position that there would be anything problematic about companies, or at least illegal, about companies just inserting language directly into these arbitration agreements, saying that class arbitration is precluded. It's not an option. And so surely that's just what companies are going to do going forward.
Right. And I guess it's surprising maybe for some that we don't have that set of circumstances already, that that type of language isn't just standard in the process already.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine it is in at least many arbitration clauses in contracts. It seems like Lamps Plus just was a little bit kind of imprecise in how they formulated this clause, and that's what generated the case. That's why it was a little bit of a complicated case.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that they didn't have that provision in there. But, you know, the prediction after the Epic Systems decision was that employers are just going to be more and more likely to include, you know, every provision that they want related to class waivers and, you know, prohibiting class arbitration. And so it's interesting that the Supreme Court kind of went out of its way to interpret that when the company could have also explicitly written in the agreement that they didn't that they prohibited class arbitration.
So do you think then the class suit should have been, or the class arbitration should have been allowed to move forward because of the fact that the error was made, it seemingly on the side of the company in this case?
Right. I mean, that's a general principle of contract law, and the FAA does say explicitly that, you know, it's not meant to preempt general principles of contract law, which are, you know, creations of the state. And so let me give you an example. Unconscionability and duress are two ways that a contract could be rendered unenforceable. So if somebody at Lamps Plus, this didn't happen, you know, holds a gun to Varela and says, sign this arbitration agreement, it's not enforceable in court.
Sure, yeah.
And that's something that a state court would say. And, you know, that those principles are generally supposed to be enforced. And, you know, they're interpreted by state law. So the FAA wasn't meant to preempt, you know, it wasn't meant to create its own set of common law about contracts. And that's what Sotomayor says is happening in her dissent.
Right. Do you think that then there are other instances out there that we may see come forward in various courts across the United States where this language was not specifically laid out in the proper manner, other companies that may have just missed in the process of putting that exact language, how the arbitration process was would move forward in a case somewhat similar to what Varela is going through?
Yeah, that's completely possible. And I think now the court has said that a district court cannot compel class arbitration where there's silence or ambiguity. So, you know, this can happen in other cases. But one of the things you asked initially that I kind of want to come back to is that, and also that what Brian was saying is, you know, a lot like this whole decision is premised on the idea of, you know, what parties have consented to.
Right.
And the idea behind the FAA is that if the parties consent to it, then it's enforceable and it's valid. And Justice Ginsburg really points out to the fact that in 1925, when the FAA was enacted, the purpose was to enable merchants of roughly equal bargaining power to enter into agreements regarding commercial disputes. And that's that principle and that kind of purpose behind it has pretty much been forgotten by the current majority.
Yeah. And I think, Brian, a lot of people would believe that you don't have, in many cases, the same bargaining power between company and employee, especially with the loss of unions as we've had in the United States over the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, imagine that you're kind of an average person, you know, you're offered a job at a company and it's just kind of standard in the employment agreement that, you know, there's this kind of arbitration clause that, you know, says that any dispute has to be resolved via arbitration, not adjudicated in the court system. Now, of course, companies are going to kind of include a clause that says that class arbitration isn't allowed. You know, as a prospective employee, I mean, there are very few people that are going to have the ability to say to a company, actually, I'd like to kind of negotiate over this arbitration clause.
Right.
Right. So, as Neil helpfully pointed out, the idea that employees consent to the arbitration clause in a way that we should view as kind of morally binding, right? Yeah. In a way that we would and should view agreements as morally binding in cases where there's equal bargaining power, I think is just not very plausible.
844-942-7866, or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. Joined in studio by Neil Makija of the law firm of Berger Montague, also a lecturer here at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, Brian Berkey, assistant professor here at the Wharton School, and also a fellow in residence at Harvard University's Safra Center for Ethics. Again, 844-942-7866, or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. So then, Neil, what potential impact, if any significant, will we see come out of this ruling moving forward?
So I think there's a few things. One, we've got to think not just in the employment context, but in the consumer context. So for example, if you purchase a product online, I'm in a case right now against Juul Labs, the e-cigarette manufacturer, where consumers are filing suit for unlawful marketing to children.
To minors, yeah.
To minors. Some of those minors purchase the product online, and there's an arbitration agreement there.
Yeah.
So right away, then Juul will seek to compel arbitration, and actually they already have, and try to knock that case out. In you know, the individual as well as their state claims. So I think one thing is that you'll see more of that, but at the same time, with these cases where there's, you know, a million potential plaintiffs, you know, vaping, there's an epidemic, there's
sure.
three, you know, it actually has doubled in recent years. So it's going to be easier for class action firms like mine, after they adapt, to file mass arbitrations instead
right.
of class actions. So then you'll take all your plaintiffs and you'll file 1,000 arbitration requests. And that is actually something that I think businesses don't want to see happen. So this actually happened to Uber, I believe, in California, where, okay, instead of one class action in a federal court, you have, you know, 1,000 Uber drivers filing for arbitration.
Right.
And part of actually the state law that still applies. So in California, the employer has to pay the arbitrator's fee. So, you know, arbitrators are basically private judges. They pay, you know, you have to pay $2,500 and then pay them on an hourly basis. That's part of why it's arguably efficient, because, you know, it's basically privatized judicial system.
Right.
So, you know, is Uber going to pay $2,500 for every single one of those drivers who are seeking arbitration? No. You know, they don't want to do that. And so they may actually want to go back to the class action and say, oh, can we actually settle this as a class? So you have to be careful what you wish for on the defense side of these.
Brian?
Yeah. I mean, so, I mean, Neil is much more of an expert on kind of these arbitration issues than I am. But, I mean, it's also costly for, you know, employees or consumers to kind of bring these cases. So, I mean, maybe, you know, some law firms would be willing to kind of front the costs, right,
yeah.
in order to, you know, kind of recover later on. But for many individuals who might want to pursue a case, having to go through sort of individual arbitration is really a deterrent. I mean,
it's absolutely a deterrent. I don't mean to say we're just going to adapt and that's it, because that's difficult and it's going to. But I'm saying we're not going to give up representing workers and employees. But certainly the baseline question of is it worth it to bring a suit changes when you can't have a class action. Because, you know, if you are, for example, filing a wage theft case or you know, maybe your employer has required you to put up personal expenses, and to you they add up to maybe $100, $200 a month or a year, and that's not enough to pay a lawyer who's that much an hour.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's gonna make it less likely you're going to pursue a claim, whereas if you could do it as on a class basis, it would be worthwhile.
Well, I guess what's interesting also about this particular case with Lamps Plus and Varela is the fact that seemingly out of these 1,300 W-2 forms where the information was released, only one was actually turned into a false tax return. Now, one for many hackers is probably all you need in the process of gaining that money that you want to get from the IRS. But if there had been 20, 50, 100 of those tax returns, or I should say of those W-2s that actually had been acted upon, then that would have qualified it, I would think, for the class action, and the court would have had to uphold what the original decision was, correct?
Yes, but I think that you can still file one without yet seeing, like, you know, you don't have to wait for the tax return to be filed.
Right.
There is a harm in kind of your personal information being disclosed
right.
in the way that it was, and I'm sure that they made that argument. And the second issue is that when you file as a class action, that also will entitle you to certain discovery that allows you to find out, okay, how many other people are similarly situated.
Right, right.
And when you file personally or are in an individual arbitration, you may not be entitled to even find out, you know, who else is in that circumstance. So we don't really know. You know,
in advance, you don't know. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. Brian, how do you think now this changes the mindset of companies in terms of this process? Because as we were saying before, the relationship between employee and employer has certainly changed over the last 20 to 30 years because of how unions and representation have been changed by the entire process.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't know how much this case by itself is going to kind of change the relationship, you know, given all of the changes that have already occurred and given the fact that, you know, as I said earlier, companies can now just kind of write in a, you know, no class arbitration clause to these contracts. I mean, I think the more general kind of move toward companies including these arbitration clauses and kind of limiting the avenues by which employees can kind of have disputes with their employers resolved really does kind of shift the balance of power very much in the direction of employers. And there are a lot of kind of concerns about the arbitration system. I mean, one of the most important ones, it seems to me, is that arbitrators themselves have significant incentives to favor businesses.
Yeah.
In the proceedings, and that's because businesses are the ones who, in effect, kind of hire the arbitrators,
yep.
You know, pay the fees, and they're the repeat customers, right? So an individual business might kind of use the same arbitrator, you know, over time in a number of cases, and they might continue to go to that arbitrator in part because the arbitrator reliably kind of gives results that are kind of favorable to them, whereas individuals, you know, an employee or an individual consumer kind of participating in an arbitration proceeding against a company is not going to be a repeat customer of the arbitrator. So when you've got, as Neil pointed out, basically a kind of privatized judicial system where some of the participants are basically making the choice of kind of which arbitrators to use in these cases. There are very powerful kind of built-in incentives to favor the parties who are making the decision about who gets to serve as an arbitrator over and over again and kind of, you know, make the money that comes with doing that.
Neil?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. There are some ways that's limited. Again, it depends on the generosity of who's drafting the agreement. You know, if JAMS is this one neutral arbitrator kind of referral source and they say, we'll give you a list of seven in your area, you take turns, the plaintiff crosses off a name and then the defendant does and then whoever's left is the arbitrator. So, you know, they try to come up with these systems. But again, that's basically at the generosity of the person drafting the agreement. The one thing that I would say is that we may also see a trend at the state level, particularly in kind of blue states, so to speak, in reacting to this. So when the Epic Systems decision came out, I remember the governor of Washington, Inslee, who's now running for president, he enacted an executive order that prohibited the state from doing business with employers who have these arbitration agreements or prohibit class waivers. So that's one thing that governors can do, because they can, you know, they can always negotiate certain agreements with their contractors or people who perform services for the government. Right. The second thing, in California, there's something called the Private Attorneys General Act, and what that allows is private citizens to file suit under the power of the Attorney General's office. So they're kind of stepping away from their own agreement that they signed and using the power of the Attorney General's office enforcing wage and hour law.
Yeah.
And that will enable them to kind of seek certain penalties against the employer. A portion of those have to go to the state, but then they can recover some of those personally.
But it also probably gives that person some level of protection in terms of bringing that type of a suit forward when you're having the use and the support of the Attorney General's office.
Exactly. Yeah. And it enables you to, you know, I think it really puts a pressure on the company in California. Most cases, of course, whether it's criminal or civil, settle. So a lot of it comes down to what happens and what leads to settlement.
But I would think that especially when you have situations like this, when it is one person versus a company, the want to settle may be a little bit less than when you have a class action and the potential penalties are significantly higher.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
844-942-7866, or if you'd like, send us a comment via Twitter, either at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. Neil Makija of the firm of Berger Montague, and also a lecturer here at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, joining me in studio along with Brian Berkey of the Wharton School. Again, 844-942-7866, or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter, at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. It's seemingly, though, Brian, that you're going to have a lot of companies now that this case has been decided, and obviously there have been others similar, that I would think a lot of companies are going through their agreements, their language, to make sure that it is absolutely clear cut as to what the process is when you have the potential of an arbitration.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think any case like this is going to kind of generate attention from companies, and they're going to kind of go through their standard employment contracts or the terms that customers agree to and kind of make the language as precise as possible so that, you know, in effect, employees and consumers have as few options as possible, and kind of the options available are going to be kind of, you know, as much kind of to the benefit of the company as possible.
How important then is it also for the employee himself or herself to understand what that process may be when they're actually even going into being hired by a particular company?
Well, so, I mean, there's a sense in which it's important just in the way that kind of understanding, you know, key terms of an agreement, you know, is sort of always important. But, you know, the thing about it is there's just not much that an employee can do, right? Yeah. I mean, as I said earlier, it's not as though somebody being hired for a typical job is going to be able to kind of try and negotiate over the terms of the arbitration clause. I mean, they're just stuck with it, right?
Yeah.
Employees, in effect, I think, have virtually no power, you know, over the terms of these clauses. So they should be aware of them, but it's not as though being aware of what these clauses say and what they imply is going to help them to kind of avoid the implications of the clauses being written the way that they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in some cases they do, because there can be a requirement that there be an opt-out provision. That's not in every state.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
In California, so in California, if you sign, you know, the arbitration agreement may very well be in the agreement, and that's totally enforceable. But they may have to include a provision to opt out.
Under what circumstances?
So other, like, for example, the like under the kind of unconscionability doctrine as California Supreme Court, you couldn't require an employee to pay that $2,500 for the arbitrator's fee because, right, you know, if they're suing for $500 in back pay,
right,
you know, to require them to pay more than, right, you know, that and to pay more than they would pay in a regular court.
Right.
You know, there are fees for courts. You know, you have to pay sometimes a couple hundred dollars just to file a case. But basically, California law says that you can't do that. That would be unconscionable to require the employee. And it also can require these opt-out clauses. But, you know, they're hidden in the contract. So it says, okay, mail a letter to the headquarters and say you don't want to sign this class waiver.
In the very small print, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that is something that employees could know. But, you know, you have to think about it. I think the average person who's, you know, signing up for a job, they're usually like happy to get it. And they're just like, let me sign the paperwork. And, you know, there's very little negotiation that happens.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Justice Ginsburg points out in the opinion that there are circumstances where there is negotiation. So, for example, some law firms have ended forced arbitration because of activism on the part of some of their recruits, particularly around the issues of sexual harassment. And they've been able to knock out those clauses. But that's, you know, a very different bargaining position than, you know, the average employee, I'm sure, of LAMPS Plus.
Great having you both with us. Nice meeting you, Neil.
Thanks a lot.
Brian, great to see you.
Appreciate it.
Neil Makija from Berger Montague and also a lecturer here at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Brian Berkey from here at the Wharton School and also a fellow in residence at Harvard University.
For more insight from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.